And then to continue the theme of this retreat, the five faculties, sometimes called the five controlling faculties, I like to think of them sometimes as the five influencing faculties, the five things that can that have an influence on us, influence how we do things and how we go about our life, and even how we see things that can have an influence. And so we're influenced by the degree of confidence that we have, and in a variety of ways. There can be confidence in foolish things. So just the fact that there's faith or confidence doesn't mean necessarily that it's wise. But it does change people's perception of themselves, what they do, and even the world around them. And then to not have confidence, to have doubt, uncertainty, that also is an influencing factor. And that influences how we see things. And then the influencing factor of effort, to how we're engaged, and to be engaged with our practice or with our life in a healthy, full way, is a different influence on us than if we don't make any effort at all, or if our effort is counterproductive, or if our effort undermines us, or if the effort is hesitant, or all kinds of things. But the kind of effort we make does have an influence on us. And then mindfulness, the degree to which we can be aware of what's happening in the present moment, also has an influence. I don't think it's said in the ancient texts that every moment of mindfulness is good, that has a good influence on whatever's going on. But certainly to see clearly it's into the situation certainly has a different influence on a situation than not seeing clearly. So to be caught up in our preoccupations, in our hostility, or our greed, or our fear, it's easy to get pulled into their orbit and then not really see very clearly, but just kind of step back or have a bird's eye view or see clearly what's going on, it has a different impact, different influence than if we're kind of swept away in things. And then samadhi has an influence on things. There's a variety of ways that samadhi can influence our perceptions and our engagement and how we see things, how we see our world and ourselves, depending a little bit on how strong the samadhi is. But the Buddha put tremendous emphasis on the role of samadhi for the purpose of seeing clearly. He said that, basically he said, the purpose of samadhi is to see clearly. He also said that a person who has samadhi, who is concentrated, will see clearly. And some people talk about samadhi as kind of equivalent to the idea of cleaning the doors of perception, cleaning the windows of perception, that there's not a lot of agitation, not a lot of projection, not a lot of emotional coloring of experience that goes on when we're in samadhi, that there it's kind of like clear seeing, or the mind is clear, the mind is settled, unagitated. And so then in that clarity and strength of samadhi, we can see more clearly what's going on here in particular ways, at least the ways the Buddha was encouraging us to see. Which leads to the last of the five faculties, which is, in Pali it's panya, prajna in Sanskrit, usually translated into English as wisdom. I like the word wisdom. To me it's kind of a heartwarming quality, the associations I have with the word wisdom. Other people have different associations with it. I don't associate wisdom with learned knowledge, but rather with a way of seeing and really understanding and perceiving or discerning what's here with clarity. And in fact, some translators say that it probably shouldn't be translated as wisdom, but rather discernment works better. And part of what's nice about discernment is that it focuses a little bit more on the act of discerning, which is always a present moment act. Whereas wisdom could be acquired wisdom. And so some people think, well, I better get wise. I'll hit the books, you know, and you know, memorize all those lists. And then I'll be really wise. My preferred translation for Panya is insight. And also for the same purpose, that it's really about the ability to see clearly what's here, more than acquired knowledge or acquired wisdom. And so, in many of these lists that the Buddha gave has to do with practice, they're often presented as progressive. There's a kind of a pattern that meditation practice follows as it goes deeper and deeper. And you can actually correlate. You can map all the different lists and kind of put them together and kind of map. And you'll see they all kind of, if you line them up next to each other, they kind of all suggest a similar pattern, and where faith would be at the beginning, and something like wisdom gets right near the end. And in between, the path to there is certainly engagement. And so with faith, you can engage. With engagement, you have a chance to become more aware and mindful. With engagement and mindfulness, there's a purifying the mind, settling the mind, and the possibility of concentration. With concentration, there's a possibility of seeing things as they are, which leads to wisdom or insight. And then if it goes on further, this pattern, they talk about what can happen next is that there is disenchantment, followed by dispassion, followed by liberation, a deep letting go. Disenchantment is a fascinating term. Some people think, well, what's wrong with enchantment? It's like part of, you know, the wonderful mystery and delight of life to be enchanted. But I think the idea here is that English word enchantment or disenchantment is no longer to be under the spell of something, no longer to be entranced with something, where we lose ourselves in that process. And so disenchantment is a process by which our ways in which we're under the spell of ideas, ideology, our passions, emotions, all kinds of things we get under the spell of, and so there's a way in which that spell begins to decrease. There's no button we push and just it's done with, but we see, we have wisdom, we have insight, and that insight, because we see clearly enough, we realize that some of the things we've been attached to, some of our pursuits, are not really worthwhile, are not really so good for us. And so then there's like, you know, it's like you begin to kind of, okay, I'm not going to be so involved, or I'm not so interested in the way I was before. Before I was completely enamored with it. I thought that was going to be the solution for it all. One of the things that I discovered in my early years of practice was how much I wanted people to like me. And that was, and to do that in the monastery, and to do that in the, working in the monastery kitchen, was bad recipes. and there were some, you know, dramatic. I think probably the IRC kitchen has been pretty peaceful compared to what the pressure cooker of a Zen monastery kitchen can be like. Before my time, there were stories of knives being thrown across the back in the 1960s, long ago. And so there's all kinds of, you know, and so anyways, it was a very, in a very painful place to try to get people to like me, especially when I became the kitchen kind of manager. I once told someone that the cucumbers, because we have this, in Zen, everything has to be just the right way. I mean, everything fits together. It's like a puzzle. And so the cucumbers have to be a certain size to fit in the size of the little bowls that people eat while they're meditating, kind of, you know, so like you have. And so I went over to this person and said, you know, those cucumbers, they need to be smaller to fit in the bowl. She burst into tears. You know, that kind of pressure cooker place, so. Anyway, so it was painful. I got to see this, and I could see how painful it was. And at some point, I became disenchanted with it. I lost, you know, it lost its allure. Started to lose, it still had power over me, but it started to lose its power. And then I kind of, I didn't really believe it anymore. Before, when I was unconscious about it, I kind of unconsciously believed it. But as I'd stopped believing it, it still came up. But I found myself just not taking it quite as seriously, or seeing it more lightly, or you know, just slowly becoming disenchanted with it, or and losing the trance. And what worked particularly well as support for that was meditation practice. Not only to see it, but meditation gave me a different through the samadhi, gave me a very different reference point of well-being that I'd never had in my life. And that sense of, oh, it's possible to have well-being without being liked. That was new. You know, all kinds of things I thought I needed to have in order to feel happier, feel well. And to feel this well-being that's there for, kind of for no reason. It's there because you're meditating. But, you know, it's not like you won the lottery or something. And so to have it just, and to bubble up from the inside and kind of radiate was quite healing for me in all the ways I was divided and at war with myself and all the difficulties I had. And this idea of wanting to be liked by everyone, I didn't need it as much because of what was starting to happen to me in meditation. And that began to relax that need. And, you know, I had something else that was better than that, that supported me. And so that was a great process. And slowly the disenchantment happened. And then with disenchantment, the next phase that this Buddha talks about is, these English words are kind of, difficult to use because of the connotations. But usually the English translation is dispassion, the lowering of passion. And so for some people, passion is a positive thing, which I concur. I think sometimes passion is a very good thing to have, the way it's used or described. But the kind of passion that's being talked about here is not a good passion. You have to kind of give the Buddhist a little bit of room to just assume that they're talking about. So like, the passion for money or the passion for power or passion for, what we're addicted to or all kinds of things that are not healthy to have. And so as we get disenchantment has to do with understanding the object of our attachment and realizing doesn't really do the trick. It's not really up to doing what I'm hoping it to do. We lose interest in it and as we change our relationship to the object of attachment, then the attachments begin to quiet down, begin to lessen. And that's the process of disenchantment. And then the next phase of this process that the suttas describe is called liberation, vimutti. And some deep letting go of how we're holding or contracted or clinging or kind of wrapped up in ourselves. And so to let go. And that's not an easy thing to do in a deep way. And I think it should be approached with a lot of respect and care. And it's kind of a sacred endeavor. It's not something you kind of approach demanding it or expecting it tomorrow and huff and puff and push. And it's really a touching and reverent thing to kind of approach this possibility of the heart really relaxing and letting go so it can feel, the heart can feel at home in itself. And so there's these influences that support that. And these five faculties are all influences that support the possibility of the heart, the mind, letting go in a deep way. And then there's this process that goes through disenchantment and dispassion. And the dispassion, those two help settle the mind, bring less agitation in the mind. Because the deepest letting go that can happen can only happen when things are a little bit quiet, when things are kind of settled or not agitated. Because as long as things are agitated in the mind is a little grasping at things and wanting things or somehow or other. And there's not enough clarity, not enough settledness. And so things have to be quiet. It's quiet. Quiet so something can kind of give away or thaw or dissolve or something. So there's this process, and there's very process-oriented. The idea of a path or a journey is really deeply embedded in these ancient texts of the Buddha teachings. And so I say all that today because now we get to the fifth one, wisdom. This isn't what I'm going to be talking about is not necessarily, or not at all, I think, something like this is something you have to now believe, or more acquired knowledge from some teacher or something, or you're supposed to get it right away. But maybe think of it more as a pointer or an indication that as practice moves along, that through the influence of these different factors, that at some point something will be realized, something will arise, some insight, some seeing of something that that will lead to this process of disenchantment, dispassion, and then letting go. So in terms of these controlling faculties, the Buddha has a very particular definition of what he means by wisdom or insight here in this context. However, the Buddha had other definitions for wisdom than how he defines it in the context of the five controlling faculties. And there are two major ones that are interesting to look at. One form of wisdom is the wisdom that has to do with how we live our lives, kind of the wider social world. And the second, that of the controlling faculties, has a lot to do with the wisdom or the insight that comes from deep practice, deep meditation practice. So two different domains for wisdom. But they overlap. They influence each other. They're connected to each other. In our kind of social world, the Buddha defined wisdom, or more likely he talked about a wise person. A wise person who's someone who is concerned with concerned with the welfare of oneself, the welfare of others, the welfare of both self and others, and the welfare of the whole world. So that's kind of, I love this definition of being a wise person, the wisdom. I think when I was younger and I thought about wisdom, I thought maybe I had to get a PhD in Buddhist studies to get some of it. I have now a certificate that tells me that I can kind of prove that that doesn't work. Painfully acquired wisdom. And so for the Buddha, a wise person, wisdom has a lot to do with how we live in our social world. And there's a tremendous amount of the teachings of the Buddha have to do about our relationship to each other as human beings. And there's a very strong sense in these ancient teachings of a mutuality, a mutual support system that goes on here in our world. And we tune into each other and we care for each other. And this definition of a wise person is one example of this. In this way that the Buddha often talked about things progressively, it's interesting then that he starts by saying a wise person is someone who is concerned with their own welfare for oneself. If that's all you heard and didn't hear the rest of it, it'd be easy to think, well, this Buddhism is self-centered, it's selfish, this practice, it's all about myself. And when I was doing Buddhist practice, I haven't heard this for years now, but back in those days, there were plenty of occasions where people would say Buddhist meditators were selfish. And somehow they were self-absorbed. They were involved, they go sit and meditate and shut out the world and close their eyes and just meditate, and that's a selfish thing to do. And it was a kind of a strange thing to say because the people who said it would spend hours in front of the television. You know, and the meditators did it for 40 minutes, you know, and exposed, you know, so why is the meditation was selfish, but spending 3 hours every evening in front of the TV was not selfish? What is, you know, watching, you know, sitcoms and things? Why that difference? And I think I suspect the reason is that meditation was put into the category of religious life. And if you're religious, you should be selfless. If you're religious, you're supposed to do religious things which are for the welfare of others. And so, because that was the reference point for this discussion, it looks selfish. And they wouldn't have said you were selfish if you spent all this time watching TV. So there's something, I think in parts and currents of Western culture, there's a very strong kind of religious ethos around how important it is to be selfless. And some religious spiritual currents of Western thought, really sacrificing yourself for the sake of others, and even suffering for the sake of others, was considered really the thing to do. And the idea of being altruistic is very important in currents of Western thought. Altruism, where you really give yourself over to the welfare and care for others, and you're not supposed to think about yourself. And so this taking care of yourself first, meditating your own welfare, that come first, for some people is problematic. Some people feel kind of uncomfortable with the whole idea and variety of things. But it's fair, I think it's fair to say for the Buddha, that was the beginning. You start there for a number of reasons. One is that when you care for the Buddha, if you want, he had this wonderful little analogy of if a person is stuck in the mud or in quicksand, if another person's next to them in the quicksand or the mud, so it tries to pull them out, the one who's doing the pulling will just sink deeper. Now, if the one that was pulled before tries pulling the other one out, that person will sink deeper. So what you need is to have someone who's on dry ground, and that person can pull out the person in the mud or in the quicksand. And so in the same way, the Buddha said, if you really want to help pull people out of the mire of suffering, the suffering world, that really helps to have someone who is no longer mired in suffering. And they can help, they can support. And so one of the reasons to focus on one's own welfare first is so that you're in a better position to support others, to help others. Another reason that the Buddha didn't talk about, but which was very important for me in my growth of practice, was that as I did my practice in the years I spent in a Zen monastery, that this idea of being self-preoccupied and focusing on myself in some kind of selfish way just didn't compute, didn't make any sense after a while. And their sense of being connected to others in the world increased dramatically. And the sense of compassion became one of the operating principles that surprised me, that it should be so strong, and that, you know, I wasn't looking to be compassionate, but that's kind of one of the consequences of the practice I did. And so it became an organizing principle of how I've been living my life is, to some degree, caring for others, concerned with others. The third reason that this emphasis on starting with oneself is that in India, not just in Buddhist India, in India, there was often an idea of the mutuality, that anyone who really does deep spiritual work, deep purification or freedom from themselves, just the fact they're doing that, they're benefiting other people. They're inspiring, they have reference point, they show what's possible, that it's actually very beneficial for everyone else. And also the idea that if you serve other people, that benefits you. So rather than serving others at your own expense, there's a way of serving or supporting or helping others, a way to do it so that you could be benefited too. So there was this mutuality. It wasn't like one or the other. So what you don't find in India, ancient India, this very strong language of altruism that exists in some parts of the West. People were really supported to go into deep practice, like, you know, by themselves for years sometimes, because the people around them felt this was benefiting society. And so whether that's how much is this true, and, you know, is for us to discover. But so anyway, so the Buddha started there, the importance of doing one's own. I guess I can go for a fourth reason, is that there's not a few people who have engaged in trying to help others who didn't do their own work first and made mistakes. They projected their own ideas, their own conditioning. They projected their own discomfort with the other situation and their own ideas of what's supposed to happen. There sometimes was a lot of, sometimes they projected their own superiority and, you know, dominance, because they're the ones that, I'm going to help you, and it just became another form of oppression. And so the idea of not doing one's own work and really kind of getting deep inside and cleaning house a little bit first can sometimes be a little dangerous. Back in the 1960s, there were, and early 70s, some of the people who came to Buddhism were people who were involved in, very actively involved in some of the big social movements of the time. And they got so discouraged by how much hate and animosity and power struggles and patriarchy, particularly, that was going on in these kind of, that scene back then. And so they have to find another way. And so they came to Buddhism to kind of work on themselves and look at all this stuff, what was going on. So for the Buddha, you kind of begin with yourself, and then the idea of caring for others, for the welfare of others, becomes an important one. And I kind of feel it becomes a natural extension of it. And then this idea of caring for self and others. I don't know what the Buddha meant by this, but to put them together like that, hyphenated, self and others, I like to think of it as the we. That there's you, there's me, and there's we, and we want to care for the relationship, we want to care for the group, who we are. And then finally, caring for the welfare of the entire world, that no one's left out of our heart, that we somehow open up and care for the, you know, everyone's well-being is important for us. And so this idea that, you know, that's one form of wisdom the Buddha taught. And he doesn't use the language of sacred at all, maybe for good reason. But I kind of, in my heart, I feel that our relationships that we have with each other is a sacred dimension of life. And it's very profound, the human connectedness that we have, what goes on in those relationships, and how we touch each other and influence each other and support each other, and in all kinds of ways, is kind of a sacred thing. And so to have that be, you know, one of the pillars of Buddhism, the welfare of self for others, self and others in the whole world, I find quite inspiring. So then you come to the whole other definition of wisdom, which is as one of the controlling faculties. And I like to think of these as being related. The primary insight, the primary form of wisdom or discernment arises from the mind that's quite still, it's concentrated, and there's a kind of, you know, filters between us and seeing our direct experience in and of itself. There's so little, there's not even the overlay of concepts on it. So if I'm looking down at the floor and see that black cushion there, meditation cushion, I would not, seeing it as meditation cushion is a projection of a concept on top of that black thing there. It could easily be a, you know, something else. And so to have direct perception of that meditation cushion, I would not see a meditation cushion, I would just see black and light and shadows and shape and something like that. It's, So direct perception is kind of letting the mind, the active mind, the mind that's spinning ideas and projecting concepts and what should be and shouldn't be and all these things, giving it a vacation, giving it a rest for a while. Not to get rid of it forever, not because it is an important part of our life when it's done wisely, but it's really useful to give it a vacation, give it a break, so we can have a very different relationship of how we see things. Very, very simple. And it's called direct perception, to see something directly, what's here, in the immediate present moment. And the Buddha said, if you can get into that kind of direct perception of the present moment, free of all the overlay of concepts, then the core wisdom, core insight that he emphasized, is to see how in the world of direct experience, direct perception, is a fluid world. It's a world that's constantly changing. It's a coming and going, appearing and disappearing, arising and passing. It's inconstant. It's in flux. And this is kind of like the central insight of early Buddhism, the insight into the impermanent nature of our experience of our life. We often use the word impermanence in English to talk about this core insight, but I think it does a little disservice to use that English word, because for many people I get the sense of, not enough people, that the word impermanence is interpreted to mean sooner or later it's going away. It's not permanent, impermanent, meaning that it's here now, but it'll disappear at some point. That's what impermanence means. This is not what the Buddha meant by impermanence. The word is anicca. The literal meaning of what's usually translated as impermanent is inconstant. Not constant. It doesn't mean that the sun in the sky is inconstant. It's up above us sometimes, and sometimes it's not. The weather is inconstant. The weather is not impermanent in the sense that we're going to be done with the weather once and for all. You know, like we're just waiting for that day, and just finally, no more weather. It's no good. But I don't know what we would have then instead, but I don't think it's... But the weather is inconstant. It comes and goes, and different weather comes and goes. Days come, nights come, days go, nights go, and they come and go. I remember when I was on these really long retreats I sat, and, you know, after many months of sitting and getting fairly concentrated, meditations went really fast. I'd sit down to meditate and it seemed like all we were doing was eating. Bell would go, and, oh, got to eat again? We just ate. So meals were inconstant, you know, they came and went. They weren't impermanent, but they were inconstant. They came and went and came and went in that kind of way. So the breathing, as long as we're alive, is inconstant. You know, there's an in-breath, comes and it goes, out-breath comes and it goes. There's all the stuff that comes and goes and comes and goes. To see the inconstancy of thinking, that thoughts just come and go, they come and go with no... I don't know about your thoughts, but there's a lot of nonsense in there. Or say it differently. I noticed this many years ago, and I teach it now when I do the intro class, that if anybody walked next to me and talked to me as much as I talk to myself, I'd be worrying about their sanity. But more amazingly is if they talked as much about themselves as I talk about myself, I would really be begging them, please stop. And the most amazing thing, so I'd lose interest in that person's, you know, constant chatter after a few days. What's the most amazing is that I don't get it so, you know, so easily bored with myself. You know, I'm like, you know, it's fascinating to have and to have the same thoughts over and over again. You do it again and again and again. I think if some of us counted how many times we thought about the same theme, you know, you get to 500, you kind of you'd wonder. And actually, Jack Kornfield sometimes has told people and instructed people to count how many times during a day, during meditation, they had certain thoughts. And it seemed to be very effective for some people to help them get disenchanted. Because you kind of don't remember, you know, how many times you've done it before. It's like every time is new and special. But if you start counting and you get a more realistic sense and you get to 338 and it's like, what am I doing? And so so this inconstancy, to be able to see thoughts come and go and come and go and come and go, it's a way of, hopefully in a healthy way, to start becoming disenchanted, not necessarily, well, disenchanted with the value of every possible thought or every repetitive thought, or disenchanted with giving so much authority to every thought or so much investment in every thought or whatever language works for you. And then to kind of not have so much passion around all these thoughts. And the passion around thinking that I've had, I mean, that's one of the advantages and sufferings of meditation, is to see how strong the passion, the attachment, the drive to think has been for me. And one of the really difficult things in meditation is if you do, you know, follow Max's instruction and develop some samadhi, and you're kind of, sometimes you get concentrated. And then for some reason, the wires in the brain maybe get a little mixed up or something. And the concentration, that power of concentration that you now acquired, leaves the breath, maybe, and goes towards an idea. And you just can't get off the idea because of that strength of that samadhi. And I spent 3 days on a 3-month retreat, right in the middle. It was amazing, 3 days. Designing helicopters. But it was a little bit more, you know, I wasn't so narrow-minded because I also started designing a business plan to sell those helicopters. And I just couldn't get off it. It was like, I was like locked in 3 days. Maybe I didn't have the wisdom I should have had to somehow figure out how to get out of that. But that was a long 3 days. So this drive and the way to be focused and fixated on certain ideas, even good ideas, healthy ideas, ideas we should have, it's possible to get fixated on them, kind of narrow down and kind of have that kind of drivenness towards them. To loosen up and get quieter and softer and not have this fixation. And then to start seeing that they come and they go, these thoughts, they come and they go. Then it's possible to have a different relationship to them. That's not really so possible if we're only, if we don't see what we're doing. We get lost in them and we don't even see that we're thinking even. We're just thinking. But to step back and see, well, there's a thought. I find that one of the great things to have insight or to see in mindfulness is to see the arising of a thought. If you can see, watch a thought arise. There was a before when it didn't exist. And now it's coming, now it's come, now it's there. To actually watch or be aware that a new thought has just arisen, it's very powerful. Because if you have that kind of mindfulness, then you might also have the mindfulness to question it. Is this really true? Is this really useful? And this is very important, I think, in our social world, because of how easy it is to have bias, all kinds of prejudice about people for all kinds of reasons. all kinds of ways, and tremendous amount of social suffering goes on in our society because of bias and prejudice and racism and all kinds of things like this. And some of that gets born in the moment, the way things are born in the present moment, moment by moment. It's born in the thought that people have. And sometimes these thoughts, because we're so busy and thinking about so many things, a lot of the thoughts are subconscious. We don't really track them, and they influence the situation. So if I see someone coming down the street, and I can watch in my mind my thought go up, thought arise, that's a dangerous person. Thought arises, I see it come up, that's a rising thought, I see it as just a thought. A thought is not the person. One of the cliches or little sayings back in India, when Vipassana, the Western teachers were first students in India, that they came up with, someone came up with, I think it's one of their teachers, and so it repeated many times. The thought of your mother is not your mother. So the thought of someone is not the same thing as the person. So to see this thought, oh, a dangerous person, you see, that's a thought. And then you put a question mark next to it. Is that really true? And then you give it a second look. Take a second look. Don't just believe the thought. This is important, how we read people, how we see people. It's very, very important to do it well. And so then look more carefully. You know, is that really the case? Look at it again. Be very careful with the kind of thoughts we have and check them out. And some, there are dangerous people. But so it happens sometimes. But probably a lot less often than what people, you know, what the thoughts people produce. And so it gives a certain power or a certain ability to monitor oneself and be wiser if we can watch the arising of thoughts. Arising of a thought about yourself. I have a couple of friends. For some reason, they have this language they like to say that they succumb into seeing themselves as a bad person. And so they have the ability sometimes to watch the birth of this thought, I'm a bad person. And because they can see the arising of it, it's just a thought. It's just a thought. What is a thought? Does a thought have any weight? Does a thought have any solidity? Does a thought come with a professional certification that it's an expert in some field? Does a thought have, a thought in and of itself? Does it require anything of us? To be able to watch the thought, I'm a bad person, arise, put a question mark next to it, or not believe it, or take a second look, or reconsider, and think it out. Is this really true? Is this a useful way of thinking? I think it's very powerful to do that. So this inconstancy, to see things come and go, allows us to see the arising of things and the passing of things. And if we can see the passing of things that that are inconstant, then we realize that they're not staying forever. And there's gaps, there's space. They're not so solid. And when they're not so solid, then it doesn't make sense to cling to them. They come and they go. It's easier to surf on them. It's easier to just watch them come and go. It's easier to have a wiser relationship to them. And, one of the things that to this day, is I still find helpful is the idea that when something occurs now in the present moment, this is just now. That little expression, this is just now, has saved me a lot of suffering. Because this is just for now. For now it's like this. It's not going to be this way later. So many of the things, it's not going to be this way later, tomorrow, the next day, it's not going to be this in this way tomorrow. I've been upset about things, or I've been enamored with things, and the things didn't go away, come and go, the ideas, the people, or something didn't come and go so much. But my way I related to it came and went. And my being enamored, or my being critical, you know, that came and went. So it's this way now. It might not be this way later. Who knows how it's going to be? It's not going to be this way later. So, because I'm not capable of sustaining, you know, certain things for, you know, nonstop. And that saved me a lot of grief, because then I didn't invest so much authority into the interpretations of the moment. Okay, so that's how it is for now. Let's see. Maybe it'll be true again tomorrow or the next day or something, but let's just see. This is how it is for now. I'm sitting in meditation. I'm in pain. I'm sitting in grief. That's just for now. When I do that, when I say that to myself, then it's a lot easier for me just to sit with it and let it move through me and be here. The grief just kind of moves through and just here. And I'm much more willing to just feel it and just be with it as it is. So this idea of that wisdom involves seeing the arising and passing, the inconstancy, the impermanence, I think is a fascinating idea. I think a profound idea. And it has many, many meanings, many ways it's applied, many ways in which, you know, it's experienced. But part of the function of mindfulness and concentration is to help us become more sensitive, more alert, more attuned to how things are changing and coming and going in all kinds of ways, all the different levels and ways in which it's done. Things come and go. And then this movement of disenchantment and dispassion, this movement of kind of watching things come and go, meals come and go, breaths come and go, days come and go, sits come and go, thoughts come and go, emotions come and go, all kinds of things. You see them coming and going. And then seeing that and being very sensitive to it in such a way that the tendency of the mind to grasp on, the tendency of the mind to solidify or resist or tighten up or coagulate, the tendency of the mind to make a self out of it or to define oneself by it or to assert oneself or diminish oneself, all these movements of self that come into play in relationship to the impermanent, fleeting experiences of the moment, these begin to stand out more in highlight. And as they stand out more in highlight, the simple movement we're looking for is not to be critical of it, not to judge it anything as wrong, or even anything as right. We're not looking at right and wrong when we get into deeper meditation. It's kind of like a right and wrong free zone. But rather, we're looking for how we can be with it, so we're just getting stiller, or more balanced, more stable, less pushed around by things, less, you know, pushed over, grabbed onto, or just be able to stand on our own two feet, metaphorically, just stand on our own two feet and be present and look reality right in the eye. Really, really be quiet and still, to let go of the agitation that comes from always wanting, always trying to figure out or solve. Kind of vacation, a stopping, all the doing. Letting the activities of the mind take a break, quiet down, soften, become stiller. Not the stillness of being frozen, but the soft stillness, maybe of an early morning dawn over a lake, or in the woods, soft, soft, still, quiet, peaceful. Or you go into a wonderful clearing surrounded by large redwood trees. And it just in that little clearing, it's so still and so peaceful and so quiet. It feels a little bit sacred there. Or sometimes in the early evening, it can be all the birds have gotten quiet and the animals, it's quiet and just very still as dusk comes along. And just sometimes it's very, very, it's almost sacred or reverent to feel the stillness. So the kind of stillness of the mind gets quieter, willing to ease up, willing to let go, willing not to be so chasing ideas and doing things. It's been quiet, peaceful. The mind kind of feels at home in itself, comfortable, deep sense of inner safety and stillness. And things get quieter and quieter. And the movement that is things getting thinner and thinner. And I liken it to, I'm very water focused, so like a very large, still lake or completely no wind, just very still and peaceful. The mind can be like that. And because at some point, it feels like there's no wanting anymore. Feels the mind has become very equanimous, lots of equanimity. No matter what happens, the mind stays peaceful. And then the last little remnant of holding on lets go of itself. You can't let go of it. It's kind of like consciousness lets go of itself. What is that? Consciousness lets go of itself. And then a person has a taste or experience of the deepest letting go that's possible. Very deep letting go. And this tremendous sense of well-being, tremendous sense of health that comes from no longer having any clinging, at least temporarily. And then the person knows something. The person knows how thoroughly, how deep it's possible to put an end to suffering, even if it's just temporarily. Wow. And that person then knows what's possible for other people. Knows that other people can also have the potential to bring their suffering to an end. They have the potential of lessening their suffering, having less suffering. And that actually everyone has this wonderful potential of not having to live with suffering. And so, what does a wise person do? One then, at that point, one lives for the welfare of others, for both self and others, and for the entire world. Because their suffering of the world is our suffering. But if it's our suffering, we share in the suffering, but there's no clinging here to that suffering. It just kind of has, it can dwell within us with a certain kind of clarity or openness or resonance that's part of freedom. So the five influencing faculties, faith, effort, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And to the degree to which there's beginning of wisdom, that has an influencing influence on us. It influences our experience, how we see, how we be, how we view ourselves. And it's a slow, progressive thing. It's something that grows. It grows as the path, the journey continues. So I wish you well on this journey, and may this rest of this day be a time that you're supported by all these influencing faculties, so that you become more just here, more just in this moment, and curious, interested, what is it that's just here when there's no agitation? What's on the other side of any agitation? What's the other side of your thoughts? What's on the other side of your suffering? What's the peace that's there? To be still, to be quiet. What can open up for you in this practice? Thank you.